You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's a letter from Washington. This ain't no disco. Saturday night, Penn Social is your typical D.C. dive, filled with conservative 20-somethings. Come Sunday morning, it's still a hot spot, but by the name of King's Church, reports Tara Palmieri, where the same cool kids congregate, professing their faith in Jesus and in Donald Trump. Opening illustration shows a neon-lit cross that has the message Jesus Saves embedded within it, with a crown at the top. Trays of shots sit waiting on the bar. Behind them, the mini-fridges of Red Bull hum softly, and a row of beer taps, dormant for now. In less than an hour, those taps will be flowing again. But for the moment, they frame a congregation of 720-somethings, many of them White House and Capitol aides. Think tank staffers, bureaucrats, and interns, standing shoulder to shoulder with their heads raised toward the disco lights, as if beseeching them for guidance. The shots aren't tequila. They are the blood of Christ, passed around on silver trays and swallowed in unison, the world's most pious drinking game. On stage, musicians scroll through New Age worship lyrics on iPhones, propped on tripods, where hymnals once might have been. The effect is half revival, half silent disco. This ain't no disco. It's King's Church, one of Washington's fastest-growing evangelical congregations, holding Sunday service inside Penn Social, the downtown bar, better known for its Tuesday beer pong tournaments and congressional mixers. Just a few blocks from the White House, King's Church has become a magnet for ambitious young conservatives, people who spend their weekdays drafting talking points, staffing hearings, and chasing proximity to power. It's a place where faith feels more like a networking event than a ritual, the kind of juxtaposition only Washington could pull off, communion by shot glass, salvation with a side of brunch. My kind of people. During the sermon, co-founder and pastor Wesley Welch, 34, tells a story about unused gift cards as a metaphor for Christians failing to cash in their spiritual balance. Quoting a Pew Research poll on prayer like a campaign briefing, "This is Washington. Even God can use better data." Welch, tall and slender, with a soft beard and soft voice, wears a black suit and floral tie, and explains he's finally reached the stage in life where he can afford to buy, not rent, a tuxedo. And thanks to an old Joseph A. Bank gift card, he could buy a dress shirt, too. He sticks strictly to the Book of Daniel, reading almost straight from Scripture in a circuitous way. It is almost shocking the crowd doesn't peel off for TikTok. "They had one shirt in my size," he marvels, "and the price was exactly what the gift card covered." He treats the coincidence as a divine nudge, delivered through a mall menswear chain famous for buy one, get three deals. A member of the Southern Baptist Convention, one of the largest Protestant denominations in the country, and also one of the most conservative, King's Church has engineered a recruitment machine that any political strategist would envy. Its ministry seems to target the interns who pour into the city each semester, offering community, mentorship, and purpose wrapped in worship. Many soon land full-time jobs, carrying the church's DNA with them. What began in 2008 with 50 worshipers in a courtyard by Marriott Conference Room, moved to the International Spy Museum. Because of course it did. Then to a high school auditorium, and now a 13,000-square-foot bar so packed that latecomers stand along the walls. While many of D.C.'s brick-and-mortar churches struggle to fill 100 seats, King's draws hundreds of 20-somethings in Lily Pulitzer dresses and dry-fit polos, coffee cups in hand, swaying beneath yellow and purple lights instead of a cross. Instead of a past basket for offerings, a QR code for the church's Venmo account glows on the wall. There's an app, too, where worshipers can join small groups and give donations. On their website, worshipers can find roommates, view job openings, listen to the podcast, and find community through joining GroupMe threads and a surprisingly active Instagram. The service even begins with a selfie of a newly engaged couple projected on the wall. After 2.5 hours, when the music stops, no one bolts. They stack their chairs and pull back the curtains, revealing the full stretch of the bar, the arcade, the skee ball, the basketball hoops, and then they network. At the door, a large man named Daquan Bruce, 29, acts as bouncer, greeter, philosopher. Bruce moonlights as a cable news pundit and is the head of public relations at West Wind Elements. We talk about the intersection of faith and, like, your career growth, he tells me at a baptism in June. The man behind him adds, God transcends politics. Perhaps. But in Washington, politics devours everything, even the sacred. It's a power center, says Matthew Bartlett, a former Trump administration appointee. Maybe even a nerve center in this new administration. The connective tissue between worship, ideology, and networking. And among the power players in D.C., it's only rising. That rise was clearest when 35-year-old co-founder Ben Palka was ushered into the Pentagon orbit by Pete Hegseth to speak in October behind the Department of War seal at one of Hegseth's Christian prayer and worship services. The initiative has already been criticized for treating the separation of church and state as more of a suggestion rather than a rule. It has featured speakers like Doug Wilson, who leads Hegseth's church and who has advocated for a male-led Christian society. Palka's presence there signaled something unmistakable. Washington is starting to treat him less like a pastor and more like a player. Senator Josh Hawley has also taken notice of King's, posting a highly produced video to his 2.4 million followers on X of his October speech on Christian manhood, secrets of a meaningful life. The clip intercuts Capitol City, Capitol Hill, cityscapes with excerpts of his remarks, a glossy signal that prominent conservatives see the church as a stage worth claiming. When asked if a Democratic leader has spoken to the congregation, Welch did not respond. Live, laugh, love. We're not super right-wing, Palka insists. He often mentions having Biden staffers in the congregation, though none of the more than 30 church members I interviewed could point one out. Still, he takes his influence seriously. Very sincerely, he tells me, and with a fear of God before my eyes. At the heart of King's Church lies the King's Collective, a semester-long internship ministry marketed with the branding precision of a Hill Comms shop. Officially, it's a discipleship program to carry the gospel into their internships. Unofficially, it's a spiritual LinkedIn. They teach how to maintain your Christian identity in politics, but for interns, says Will S., 33, who works in national security. I don't know any other church that seeks after interns the way King's does. The congregants are media savvy. Many refuse to give full names to avoid appearing to speak for their offices. You know, politics is very scary, says Bennett Young, a senior at the University of Mississippi who's interning for Marjorie Taylor Greene. But if you see people that you work with coming into church every Sunday, it means a lot. Young says everyone in Greene's office embraces the church, so much so that you can imagine the pressure interns feel to show face. During a baptism service in June, I find myself seated next to a woman who describes herself as Senator Katie Britz, Republican from Alabama, intern coordinator, who brought two staffers. Another young woman said she was encouraged to recruit from her office. Lydia, 23, found King's through a colleague at the Leadership Institute. She later networked her way into the Heritage Foundation, another institution with a conspicuously strong presence here. Brad Robertson, the 26-year-old college and intern director, worked there. So did lay pastor Daniel Davis. The pitch is irresistible for any ambitious 20-something alone in the Capitol: instant community and a fast pass to relevance. It's really helpful for interns to hear, maybe from a lawyer's perspective, or a lobbyist, or maybe someone who works on the Hill, says another intern from Green's office who declined to give her name. They help a lot with different opportunities. The men behind King's Church understand this dynamic intimately. So, for me, D.C. was my kind of people, says Palka, Welch's co-founder. I like politics. I like the drama of it. I want to reach and impact these kinds of people. I wanted to be rubbing shoulders with these kinds of people. Welch and Palka are an unlikely pair. Welch has the warmth of a Southern youth pastor. He grew up in an evangelical family in Georgia. Palka, with a flat top and clean shave, looks more like a Marine than a minister. He grew up in Buffalo with a Catholic father and Episcopalian mother who baptized him in a bathtub, a decision that still mystifies him. A lifelong student government kid, he found God in college, wandering into a church service. After the service, I visit their row house near Capitol Hill. Next to a mechanic's garage, it feels more like a frat annex than a rectory. Spotlights illuminate built-in bookshelves. A framed QR code for the church app, home goods style live, laugh, love decor, and inspirational Christian titles like Love Your Church by their mentor Tony Morita and The Reason for God by Timothy Keller, whose Manhattan movement, Redeemer City to City Church, similarly drew young urban professionals into a powerful finance and art network. Upstairs, the counseling room features a green velvet swivel chair, a tufted brown leather couch, a paper lamp, and a raw wood table. A gilded frame of the Last Supper is tucked in the corner. Palka explains that he abandoned a career in defense contracting and even turned down an FBI job to pursue ministry. After struggling for 2 years to grow beyond 50 congregants, he and Welch gained traction by tapping interns from Liberty University, which now funnels students into King's each semester. It also helps that they remained open throughout most of COVID. They met at an ice cream shop near the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, where they studied under church planter Morita. There, they formed their plan, Storm Washington. Eight years, 250 baptisms. Washington has always attracted spiritual entrepreneurs, from pastors seeking proximity to presidents to Christian nationalists eager to break down the wall between church and state. Recently, megachurches with deep pockets have made their move. Passion City from Atlanta expanded to D.C. in 2018, and more recently, Christian nationalist Wilson, the Idaho pastor and advisor to Hegseth, helped launch Christ Church on Capitol Hill last summer at the Conservative Partnership Institute. We understand that worship is warfare. We mean that, Pastor Jared Longshore warned in one of Wilson's services, according to Christianity Today. The timing, paired with the zealotry at Charlie Kirk's funeral and Trump's revival of the White House faith office, has made a soft theocracy feel less fringe and more inevitable. But Welch and Palka aren't fire and brimstone populist. They are careful, disciplined. They speak moderation while building something more durable, nurturing a generation of young conservatives who will carry their teachings into agencies, congressional offices, the judiciary, and a returning Republican administration. So does King's function as a soft power pipeline for young conservatives in Washington? Its leaders bristle at the suggestion. We have nothing to do with getting people jobs. We have never, ever, ever done that, says Palka. I do think it could be a byproduct, though. Part of the Christian faith is that we don't compartmentalize it, says Welch. So we want people to see that it does influence your career, just like how your faith influences your family, your relationships, your kids. So that's just natural to how the church operates. It's not like this is the goal. King's has done 250 baptisms in 8 years. Palka jokes more than once that I could be baptized at their next ceremony. When I ask how long it takes to join the church, he smiles. It could take 15 minutes. It could take 15 years. He believes Gen Z is drawn not to megachurch gimmicks like slingshots and ziplining pastors, but to ancient ritual. King's recites the Nicene Creed weekly, rare among evangelical churches. Members must affirm 9 core beliefs: God as Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Jesus fully God and fully human, born of a virgin, lived without sin, died, rose again, and will return to judge the living and the dead. Scripture is final. The church must carry out Christ's mission until he returns. They're looking to retrieve some of those anchors that have been lost, Palka says. This is something the young people are flocking to, the high church liturgy. Space, not attendance, is King's real problem. Expansion plans to cities like Paris and Berlin are on hold until they secure a permanent space in D.C., and they need money. Their flock consists largely of interns and junior staffers, earnest but broke. Palka knows that securing a physical home would give King's another ring of relevance, one more proof that the church can be an institution. We thought we'd have a building by now, says Palka. You can hit up a denomination for funding, but this capital campaign, it's been very slow. Worshippers show up a half hour early to claim seats, and some longtime congregants have grumbled about the intern influx. One faction, calling itself King's Church Members Take a Stand, lines the back wall to save room for newcomers. They launched with a $50,000 loan from the Southern Baptist Convention's North American Mission Board, small by megachurch standards, but enough to launch a movement. I would love if we had a building of our own one day, Palka says. All the statistics say it gives the church credibility. It makes it more real in people's eyes when you see that it's their location. Robertson, the 26-year-old running the intern ministry, may be one of the church's most influential figures. It's a really interesting city, he says. The fact that 25-year-olds kind of run the government. He is, in effect, their shepherd. Conservatism, Inc. For interns living on stipends, King's offers free lunches, nationals tickets, and speaker events featuring K Street veterans, senior aides, operatives, and even a Fox News producer. There are mixers, too, where future staff assistants meet future legislative directors. For the Republican Party, that makes King's more than a church. It's a long-term investment. If someone here hears about an opportunity, like a staff position opening up, says Noah Larson, 25, and operations director and Representative Claudia Tinnies, Republican from New York, office, I'll ask, just flag it for a minute and say, hey, you know, pass in your resume. He's already helping his twin brother find a job through the congregation. What makes King so startling, even unnerving, for the secular left is how, without effort, it fills a void progressives never cracked, blending identity, community, and political machinery. Conservatives have spent years perfecting what insiders call Conservatism, Inc., the pipeline of fellowships, think tank roles, K Street apprenticeships, and administration jobs. Seeing that ecosystem emerge inside a church signals an escalation. I've seen Conservatism, Inc. working to engage churches, says Tina Nguyen, author of the MAGA Diaries, but I've never seen something like a church become a networking hub for young career conservatives. To start at the tail end of the first Trump administration and to be catching fire now with the returning Republican administration is great timing, says Gary Marks, the former executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition and a veteran of Bush-Cheney. National Community Church, once the underground church frequented by conservative staffers on the Hill that grew from Union Station's basement movie theater into a Northern Virginia megachurch, never built a pipeline like this. King's is different. It is strategic, hungry, and very aware of its moment. At $2,200 per Sunday, the church has the venue only until 1 p.m., as Polka shepherds people up the stairwell, pop begins to blare, a photo booth rolls across the bar, high tops scrape into place, and arcade games flicker back to life before football fans pour in for their own kind of ritual devotion. The church members disperse into the city to their legislative memos and policy drafts, carrying with them the gospel and the group chat. A new power is taking root in Washington. It doesn't march or lobby or storm the Capitol. It pours coffee, sings under disco lights, baptizes interns, and sends them into the machinery of government. And it grows every Sunday. Abby Baker contributed reporting to this article. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with a portrait by Gil Button, Keith McNally, the restaurateur, memoirist, and champion Instagram captioner, happily names names, but has regrets as well. Admiring Woody Allen is not one of them. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Taking an overnight train in Europe. On what occasion do you lie? When I want to sleep with someone. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Can't make your dinner party because I have COVID. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Shoeless Joe Jackson. What is your greatest fear? My children dying before me. Which living person do you most admire? Woody Allen. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Craving the kind of success I pretend to despise. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Using knowledge as a weapon. What is your greatest extravagance? Basking in a modesty I don't possess. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Conspicuous humility. What do you dislike most about your appearance? A voice that shot to pieces. What is your greatest regret? Not having regular checkups before my stroke. What or who was the greatest love of your life? My 6-year-old granddaughter, Olive. When and where were you happiest? Cycling around Martha's Vineyard alone in the summer of 1976. Which talent would you most like to have? The talent to look into a mirror and not despise the person staring at me. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? To be more straightforward, I think. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Commit to memory the Philip Larkin line. They F you up, your mom and dad. What do you consider your greatest achievement? The failure of my suicide attempt in 2018. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Orson Welles. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Lake Geneva. What is your most treasured possession? A belief in due process. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Weddings. What is your favorite occupation? Sports writer. What is your most marked characteristic? Fear of embarrassing myself. What is your motto? When being tortured, name names. Who are your favorite writers? Shakespeare, Thomas Hardy, Chekhov, Jane Austen, Guy de Maupassant, Dickens, Tolstoy, and John Cheever. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Alec Lemus, the anti-hero, and John le Carré's The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. Who are your heroes in real life? Steffi Graf and former UK politician Rory Stewart. What are your favorite names? Fanny Squeers and Augustus Snodgrass, characters from Dickens novels. What is it that you most dislike? Inauthenticity. How would you like to die? During sexual intercourse. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Keith McNally. eye of the hurricane. Throughout the first year of Donald Trump's second administration, Chris Whipple has interviewed Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, at every moment of crisis. His insider's account of Trump 2.0 joins the photography of Christopher Anderson for a portrait of power and peril. Opening photo shows Carolyn Leavitt, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Marco Rubio sitting around a desk. On the morning of November 4, 2025, an off-year election day, White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles was meeting in the Oval Office with the President and his top advisors, men she calls her core team, Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Stephen Miller, Deputy Chief of Staff. The agenda was twofold: ending the congressional filibuster and forcing Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power. As she related it later, President Donald Trump was holding forth on the filibuster when Wiles stood up and started for the door. Trump eyed her. "Is this an emergency that you have to leave?" he demanded. It was nothing of the sort, but Wiles left Trump guessing. She replied, "It's an emergency. It doesn't involve you." With that, according to Wiles, she departed from the Oval. Wiles, wearing dark pants and a plain black leather top, met me in her office with a smile and a handshake. Over sandwiches from the White House mess, we talked about the challenges Trump faces. Throughout the past year, Wiles and I have spoken regularly about almost everything: the contents and consequences of the Epstein files, ICE's brutal mass deportations, Elon Musk's evisceration of USAID, the controversial deployment of the National Guard to U.S. cities, the demolition of the East Wing, the lethal strikes on boats allegedly being piloted by drug smugglers, acts many have called war crimes, Trump's physical and mental health, and whether he will defy the 22nd Amendment and try to stay on for a third term. Most senior White House officials parse their words and speak only on background. But over many on-the-record conversations, Wiles answered almost every question I put to her. We often spoke on Sundays after church. Wiles, an Episcopalian, calls herself Catholic Light. One time we spoke while she was doing her laundry in her Washington, D.C. rental. Trump, she told me, has an alcoholic's personality. Vance's conversion from Never Trumper to MAGA acolyte, she said, has been sort of political. The vice president, she added, has been a conspiracy theorist for a decade. Russell Voigt, architect of the notorious Project 2025 and head of the Office of Management and Budget, is a right-wing absolute zealot. When I asked her what she thought of Musk reposting a tweet about public sector workers killing millions under Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, she replied, "I think that's when he's microdosing." Wiles is the most powerful person in Trump's White House, other than the president himself. Unlike any chief of staff before her, she is a woman. So many decisions of great consequence are being made on the whim of the president. And as far as I can tell, the only force that can direct or channel that whim is Susie, a former Republican chief told me. In most White Houses, the chief of staff is first among a bunch of equals. She may be first with no equals. "I don't think there's anybody in the world right now that could do the job that she's doing," Rubio told me. He called her bond with Trump an earned trust. Vance described Wiles' approach to the chief's job. "There is this idea that people have that I think was very common in the first administration," he told me, "that their objective was to control the president or influence the president or even manipulate the president, because they had to in order to serve the national interest. Susie just takes the diametrical opposite viewpoint, which is that she's a facilitator, that the American people have elected Donald Trump, and her job is to actually facilitate his vision and to make his vision come to life. It's been a busy year. Trump and his team have expanded the limits of presidential power, unilaterally declared war on drug cartels, imposed tariffs, according to Wim, sealed the southern border, achieved a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza, and pressured NATO allies into increasing their defense spending. At the same time, Trump has waged war on his political enemies, pardoned the January 6th rioters, firing nearly everyone involved in their investigation and prosecution, sued media companies into multi-million dollar settlements, indicted multiple government officials he perceives as his foes, and pressured universities to toe his line. He's redefined the way presidents behave, verbally abusing women, minorities, and almost anyone who offends him. Charlie Kirk's assassination in September turbocharged Trump's campaign of revenge and retribution. Critics have compared this movement to a Reichstag fire, a modern version of Hitler's exploitation of the torching of Berlin's parliament. Historically, the White House's chief of staff is the president's gatekeeper, confidant, and executor of his agenda. That often means telling the president hard truths. Upon taking office, Ronald Reagan was hell-bent on reforming Social Security. James A. Baker III explained to him that cutting Social Security benefits was the third rail of American politics. Reagan pivoted to tax cuts and was ultimately reelected in a landslide. Donald Rumsfeld, Gerald Ford's chief, explained, "The White House chief of staff is the one person besides his wife who can look him right in the eye and say, 'This is not right. You simply can't go down that road.'" And how far will Trump veer off the guardrails of democracy? The question around Wiles' tenure under Trump has been whether she will do anything to restrain him. A better question, does she want to? T-minus 9 days, January 11th, 2025. Our first conversation took place little more than a week before the inauguration. Wiles called from the road, en route from Mar-a-Lago to her home in Pontevedra, Florida, in her BMW 530. She was in high spirits, basking in Trump's victory. "Not that she'd ever doubted the outcome. At no point did I think we would not win," she said. "Not in my core, not in my sleep, not in my rational mind." But on that January day, as his second inauguration approached, Wiles was determined to show the world a new Trump. "I told Hakeem Jeffries, 'You will see a different Donald Trump when he gets there,'" she recounted to me. "I've not seen him throw anything. I've not seen him scream. I didn't see that really horrible behavior that people talk about and that I actually experienced years ago." Wiles' childhood had prepared her for difficult men. She was raised in Stamford, Connecticut, and Saddle River, New Jersey, the only daughter and eldest of three siblings. It was her famous father, Pat Summerall, who put Wiles on a path to the pinnacle of political power. Summerall had been a kicker for the New York Giants, and afterward parlayed his knowledge and mellifluous baritone into fame and fortune as the voice of the NFL. At her father's knee, Susie Summerall became a football aficionado, rattling off win-loss records and player stats like a miniature John Madden, an ability she says Trump shares. The president, it turns out, is a junkie of that and is like a statistical savant, she said, and I remember a lot of it. As a child, Susie also absorbed the zeitgeist of her father's 1970s Manhattan. "Much of what Donald Trump remembers about the New York of the 70s I lived through with my dad," she said. "So when he talks about Frank Sinatra's bodyguard, I know that name." Steve Witkoff, Trump's real estate friend turned special envoy, says Wiles and Trump are creatures of that same bygone era. "That whole world of the Copacabana and Sammy Davis Jr. and all, those are things that he wants to talk about." The most valuable gift Susie got from her dad was hard-earned. Summerall was an absentee father and an alcoholic, and Wiles helped her mother stage interventions to get him into treatment. Summerall was sober for 21 years before his death in 2013. Alcoholism does bad things to relationships, and so it was with my dad and me, Wiles said. Some clinical psychologist that knows 1 million times more than I do will dispute what I'm going to say, but high-functioning alcoholics, or alcoholics in general, their personalities are exaggerated when they drink, and so I'm a little bit of an expert in big personalities. Wiles said Trump has an alcoholic's personality. He operates with a view that there's nothing he can't do. Nothing. Zero. Nothing. Susie Summerall got her first taste of politics in the late 1970s, interning as a college student in the Capitol Hill office of Jack Kemp, the New York congressman, who'd been a giant with her father. Then, at 23, she landed a job in the Reagan White House as a scheduler, where she watched his chief of staff, Baker, in action. She married a GOP advance man, Lanny Wiles, and in 1984, they moved to Ponte Vedra. Wiles wanted to start a family and a life outside politics. But in 1988, Baker lured Wiles back to work with Dan Quayle, George H.W. Bush's running mate. The couple had two daughters, Katie and Caroline. Wiles plunged into state politics, and over the next two decades became a formidable political strategist, serving as chief of staff to the mayor of Jacksonville, Florida, running Rick Scott's gubernatorial campaign, and briefly leading John Huntsman's campaign for president. In 2015, Wiles was invited to Trump Tower to meet the real estate tycoon turned presidential candidate. The star of The Apprentice couldn't believe he was talking to the daughter of the great Pat Summerall. "He said it a million times," Wiles said. "I judge people by their genes." Wiles thought Trump was interesting and smart. "And they called me one night and said, 'We are serious about Florida now. Would you like to co-chair our leadership team?' And I said, 'Yeah, I would.'" "I had become disenchanted with what we now call traditional Republicans," she recalled. Wiles' relationship with Trump almost ended at his Miami golf club one night in the fall of 2016. Unhappy with a poll showing him doing worse than expected in Florida, Trump berated her in front of a gaggle of cronies. "It was an horrific hour plus at midnight," Wiles told me, "and I don't think I've seen him that angry since. He was ranting and raving, and I didn't know whether to argue back or whether to be stoic. What I really wanted to do was cry." Wiles steeled herself. "I finally said, 'You know, Mr. Trump, if you want somebody to set their hair on fire and be crazy, I'm not your girl. But if you want to win this state, I am. It's your choice.'" Wiles walked out. Trump turned on a dime. Lo and behold, he called me every day. Wiles never looked back. Trump carried Florida, the first big prize in his stunning 2016 upset over Hillary Clinton. Then, in a fateful turn of events, Wiles went to work in 2018 for an ambitious gubernatorial candidate named Ron DeSantis. Trump urged DeSantis, then his protege, to hire her. She led the underdog candidate to victory. But afterward, DeSantis turned on her, denouncing Wiles publicly and bad-mouthing her privately. To this day, Wiles doesn't know what triggered the governor's vendetta. "I think he thought I was getting too much attention, which is ironic," she told me. "I don't ever seek attention." Wiles landed on her feet, organizing Florida for Trump's 2020 re-election bid. Trump had rescued Wiles, recently divorced, at a dark moment in her life. Wiles and her husband divorced in 2017, due, she has said, to his bad financial decisions. Looking back on DeSantis' behavior, Wiles reflected, had he said, "Look, thank you, I appreciate your help, we're done here," I believe the course of his history would have been different. I might or might not have gone to work for Donald Trump. Day 1, January 20th, 2025. On Trump's first day in office, the president signed a flurry of executive orders, 26 in all, withdrawing the U.S. from the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement, rescinding birthright citizenship, sending troops to the southern border, freezing foreign aid, and stopping federal hiring. Then Trump issued pardons to almost everyone convicted in the bloody January 6, 2021 assault on the Capitol, in which 9 people ultimately died and 150 were injured. Even rioters who'd beaten cops within an inch of their lives were set free. 14 people convicted of seditious conspiracy had their sentences commuted. Did she ever ask the president, "Wait a minute, do you really want to pardon all 1,500 January 6 convicts, or should we be more selective?" "I did exactly that," Wiles replied. "I said, I am on board with the people that were happenstancers or didn't do anything violent. And we certainly know what everybody did because the FBI has done such an incredible job." Trump has said his FBI investigators were corrupt and part of a deep state. But Trump argued that even the violent offenders had been unfairly treated. Wiles explained, in every case of the ones he was looking at, in every case, they had already served more time than the sentencing guidelines would have suggested. So, given that, I sort of got on board. According to court records, many of the January 6th rioters pardoned by Trump had received guidelines that were lighter than the guidelines. "There have been a couple of times where I've been outvoted," Wiles said, "and if there's a tie, he wins." Next photo is of Susie Wiles. In the West Wing, Wiles is surrounded by young MAGA men. She is a go-to-church every Sunday, uses a swear word very, very rarely person, said James Blair, Wiles' 36-year-old deputy chief of staff. She doesn't raise her voice, but she likes being around junkyard dogs. Indeed, Wiles has seemed content to let her pit bulls, Deputy Chiefs of Staff Miller, Blair, and Dan Scavino, run loose as she watches. During Oval Office events, Wiles almost always sits just off camera. "There's the president, and then there's whoever the 3 high-ranking people are on the sofa," she said. "And then there's a chair at the corner of the sofa, which is my chair, which means I'm the one that gets hit in the head with the boom mic." For all the chaos in the cabinet, Wiles has kept palace intrigue and shivving to a minimum in the White House. Trump has empowered her. When Wiles weighs in, everyone knows she's speaking for him. She has in turn empowered her team, Blair, Miller, Scavino, and Taylor Budowich, who departed in September. "First and foremost, she brings no ego," says Blair, "and that is the starting point from which just an immense amount of power flows. There's so much ego and testosterone around her, there wouldn't be any room for hers anyway." From day one, Wiles had to grapple with another power center, Elon Musk. "He is a complete solo actor," said Wiles, of Trump's billionaire pal, who led the scorched earth blitz known as the Department of Government Efficiency. Wiles described Musk as something akin to a jacked-up Nosferatu. "The challenge with Elon is keeping up with him," she told me. "He's an avowed ketamine user, and he sleeps in a sleeping bag in the EOB, Executive Office Building, in the daytime, and he's an odd, odd duck, as I think geniuses are. You know, it's not helpful, but he is his own person." Musk triggered the first true crisis of the Trump presidency, and an early test for Wiles. Trump's chief was shocked when the SpaceX founder eviscerated USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. "I was initially aghast," Wiles told me, "because I think anybody that pays attention to government and has ever paid attention to USAID believed, as I did, that they do very good work." In his executive order freezing foreign aid, Trump had decreed that life-saving programs should be spared. Instead, they were shuttered. Next, photos. House proud. A statuette of President Donald Trump sits at the copier in Susie Wiles' support staff office. The staff entrance to the West Wing, away from the prying eyes of the press. James Blair apparently wears many hats. Wiles' office bookshelf. Doorknobs. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. departs the White House on November 13th. The flag from J.D. Vance's inauguration ceremony, a Marine stand sentry, challenge coins, which are on various displays throughout the White House, a picture of old friends in better times, scripture embossed with one of Vance's previous names, and Vice President J.D. Vance. When Elon said, "We're doing this," he was already into it, said Wiles, and that's probably because he knew it would be horrifying to others. But he decided that it was a better approach to shut it down, fire everybody, shut them out, and then go rebuild. Not the way I would do it. Wiles knew that fixing this was on her. "The president doesn't know and never will," she told me. "He doesn't know the details of these smallish agencies." Wiles says she called Musk on the carpet. "You can't just lock people out of their offices," she recalls telling him. At first, Wiles didn't grasp the effects that slashing USAID programs would have on humanitarian aid. "I didn't know a lot about the extent of their grant making." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.